Nice to see you here again. And once again, we will begin with a prayer. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Father, awaken in us that desire for you which is within each of us and is truly the greatest desire of our life. Direct our thoughts and words today by your holy inspiration, and bring us to understanding through the light of your Son, our Savior Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen.
When Pope John Paul II wrote his encyclical Faith and Reason in 1998, one of the fundamental questions that he asked Christians to examine was, why is there evil? It's a distressing question, but one which we really cannot avoid. In Lent, we're preparing for the joy of Easter, but we know that first we will come to Good Friday, and on that day we will witness the awful suffering and cruel death of an innocent man. The problem of evil is a question which torments us as believers above all. Why does our loving God permit evil in his world? This world which he made and declared to be good. Isn't God in some way responsible? Now, it's traditional in philosophical discussions to see the problem of evil as a trial, and God is on trial. God is the accused. How can we defend him? How can we win for him a not guilty verdict? You probably know that lawyers are meant to defend their clients whether they are innocent or not. And apparently, if you are a lawyer, it's not a good idea to ask your client if they actually committed the crime. But let's face it, God is not an easy client. The evidence against him is pretty bad. First, let us be clear. A crime has been committed. Some religious groups suggest that evil is a product of the mind, that it has no objective reality, that you can wish it away. That is not the belief of Christianity or Judaism. The Bible is full of the reality of evil, and the world certainly is no better now. No wonder people sometimes say that they've given up watching TV news. Philosophers have traditionally distinguished between two kinds of evil. They call it moral evil and natural evil. Moral evil involves the things that humans choose to do. Murder, rape, theft, the unjust crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth 2,000 years ago, ethnic cleansing, torture, and the wars which continue at this very moment. These things are certainly not the will of God, but they happen because God has left us the freedom to choose between right and wrong. Now, most of the time, we accept that wrong choices are a fair price to pay for freedom. We acknowledge that we humans are guilty of these crimes, not God. But even this generally accepted defense of God, which we call the free will defense, seems less convincing when we're faced by horrors on the scale of the Jewish Holocaust. You know, there was evil chosen by human beings. God was not responsible. And yet the scale of it is so awful, we feel, you know, God should have done something. However, moral evil is not the whole story. There is also natural evil, the sufferings which cannot be blamed on the misuse of free will. Earthquakes, hurricanes, floods, disease, these horrors too happen every day. Now, who is responsible for those? The evidence looks so bleak for our client because God was on the scene of the crime. In the first talk, we said that God is not only the creator of the world, but is responsible for the development of the world even now. Is he then responsible for the volcano and flashes of lightning, for cancer and the AIDS virus? For a time, Christians seem to have found a way to get God out of this problem. In the 18th century, a modified form of Christian belief, it was called deism, was very popular. Most of the founders of America were not actually true theists, they were deists. It was a theory that God had created the world like the designer of a complex machine, and then he had set it running. It was not his fault if screws came loose and mistakes showed up at a later stage. God, in this view, was seen as an absentee landlord with no responsibility for what goes on in the house that he has rented out. But deism is not the same as theism. That is our type of belief, the orthodox belief of mainstream Christianity. We do not believe in an absent God. For us, God is present and active in our world. And our world is the scene of the crime. There's the further problem that we believe our God to be omnipotent, powerful in every way. Christians do not believe in a cosmic struggle between two separate and equal powers, or believe that God is limited. You do get some religions which have this sort of the power of evil, the power of good, and they're constantly struggling. But we do not believe that God is somehow, you know, an equal power with the power of evil. We believe he is powerful in every way. If you did believe in that sort of division, you'd get God off the hook. But it would also mean admitting that God is not God. Finally, and this is the most distressing part of the problem of evil, we believe that God is loving. How can we explain his lack of action to save us from suffering? So, to take on the role of the public prosecutor, let me present you, the jury, with a swift recap of the evidence. Multiple crimes have been committed. God was at the scene of the crime and sometimes appears to have been the only person present. God apparently had the power to stop the crime from happening, and yet he acted with total indifference. It looks bad, doesn't it? Now, St. Augustine, who did not shy away from this problem, has stated the case very well, very succinctly in his writings. He said this: either God cannot abolish evil, or he will not. If he cannot, then he is not all powerful. If he will not, he is not all good. Let me just repeat that. Either God cannot abolish evil, or he will not. If he cannot, then he is not all powerful. If he will not, then he is not all good all-loving. So even the great philosophers, saints like Saint Augustine and Saint Thomas Aquinas, for them, God looks guilty. More poignantly, he looks guilty to the mother whose child is ill, to the earthquake victims who have lost their homes, to the widower, the widow, and the orphan. What then can we say in defense of God? How can we answer Pope John Paul's question, why is there evil? And in particular, explain the natural evil which does not depend on human choice. Saint Augustine, having stated the problem, changed his prosecutor's robes to take on the case for the defense. His plea on behalf of God lasted a very long time, although I think you'll find it unsatisfactory these days. First of all, Augustine is very insistent that God did not create anything evil. As the book of Genesis says, everything is good. God looked at it as it was made and said, "This is good." So Augustine explains that evil is not a something. It is not made by God. It is a nothing. It is a lack of goodness, a lack of something positive. Now, to explain this, you'll get the idea if you think of light. If you open a box, Light is something. You can shine a flashlight into a dark place and it takes the darkness away. Something new has come in. But darkness is not something. It's simply a lack of light. Now, if you open a box, the darkness does not spill out of the box and make the room darker. It doesn't make the room more gloomy. So, shine the flashlight into the box, there's a change. Open the box, the darkness does not come out. Light is a something, darkness is a nothing. In other words, darkness is not something, it is a no thing. And the same is true, St. Augustine said, of evil. Pain, disease, earthquakes, spots on your nose, these are all places where goodness is missing. But we are bound to ask, how are these blots on the landscape possible? Why is the original goodness missing? Why suddenly is there a lack of goodness, which means there is that negative no thing? Well, Augustine at this point brings in the free will defense. We have to remember he was writing in about 400 AD, and he believed literally in the Bible. So he says the original perfection of the world, that goodness everywhere, began to go wrong when some of the angels, notably Lucifer, and then following on from that, the first humans, deliberately chose to do evil. Natural evil followed from this moral evil, because humans were neglecting to look after the earth, and also because God sent natural evils as a punishment for evil deeds. You know how the Garden of Eden, the man and the woman were meant to look after everything and see that everything continued good. Well, when they were kicked out of the Garden of Evil because of their evil choices, then things began to go wrong. And then also, Genesis mentions that they would be punished You know, Adam would have to work. He'd have to suddenly start working and earn his living by the sweat of his brow. Woman would be punished by the pains of giving birth. And so, natural evil follows from moral evil, but also it can be a punishment. And so all evil, Augustine says, is sin or the punishment of sin. So sin is those wrong choices or the punishment of sin which God gives after that those wrong choices. Now that kind of teaching has had a long-term effect on human thought, so that people ask themselves when tragedy strikes, what have I done to deserve this? You know, why is God punishing me? Certainly it was assumed in the Middle Ages that sickness was a punishment for sin. And if apparently good people became ill, local gossip began to suggest that they must have committed some secret sin. You know, people said, well, that seems like a good person, but there must be some secret sin that God is punishing. The point is that Augustine defends the Creator by putting the whole blame on his human creatures. God walks free. What is more, lest any unhappy memories of evil should survive, Augustine insisted that at the end of time, all sinners would be banished to hell. Augustine seems to think of God as an accountant balancing the books. Somehow a strong punishment cancels out the evil that was done. As he says, the penalty of sin corrects the dishonor of sin. So he imagines all those people in hell, in some way they're kind of making up for their evil, and the books are clear, you know, God is not responsible. It's as if, you know, a sound beating will repair the window that a careless boy has broken. You know, if the boy throws a ball through the window, smashes it, you know, if you give him a good enough beating, everything's all right. Well, in fact, the window is still broken. As I said, the explanation does not convince us quite as much as it might have convinced people in the past. So, if we take the role of prosecutor again and, you know, begin to ask questions, we'll want to ask some questions of St. Augustine's client. First of all, why did the angels, perfect creatures in a perfect world, choose to do wrong? You know, why did Lucifer suddenly get this idea in his head to, you know, tempt the first human beings? Even Augustine puzzled over this, and his conclusion was that some of the angels got less grace than the others. But if that's the case, God surely has some responsibility. Also, we can question Augustine's insistence that all natural evil is a consequence of moral evil. Now, you can see a connection sometimes. When people choose to smoke or drink excessively, then very often they become sick. But sadly, good people also suffer. You know, people who have led a perfectly healthy, good life suddenly find themselves ill. In fact, several writers pointed out the weakness of this kind of explanation after the Lisbon earthquake in 1755. If you go to Lisbon, you know, the capital of Portugal, it's in some ways rather a disappointing city, because although it's been there for centuries and centuries, there's not a lot which is truly ancient and historical, because in 1755 there was this enormous earthquake which really destroyed the city. Now, people who were in church on that day, the churches collapsed. They were all killed. The people who didn't care about going to church were out in the squares drinking in the cafes or the pubs or whatever that there were in those days. They were fine. Nothing collapsed on them. So it just didn't add up that the good people had all been killed and, the bad people were perfectly all right. And of course, geologists were soon able to point out that there were floods and earthquakes around long before humans appeared on Earth. So the link between bad human choices and divine natural punishments was questionable. I think St. Augustine's can be said to have earned his advocate's fee, but the jury is still out. Perhaps God is guilty for the evil in the world after all. That's why I feel it's necessary to call in another defense lawyer, St. Irenaeus. Now, he's actually more ancient than St. Augustine. He was writing of around 200 AD. Irenaeus was a very subtle thinker, and his plea in defense of God has been revived by a number of philosophers in recent years. First, he did not believe that we humans were created perfect and then have fallen. Rather, he thought that we start from imperfection and then painfully and gradually need to develop towards perfection. Now, obviously, this fits in with the theory of evolution, where, humans were kind of like primitive beings and then have become more sophisticated. They have developed. God gives us space for growth, a bit like a good parent who gives their child more and more freedom. Raising a child, you have to gradually give them freedom because eventually they're going to grow up and have, go away to college and so on. And they've got to lead their own lives. So inevitably humans misuse their freedom and make mistakes, but we can learn from our mistakes, and even when we're learning from our mistakes, God never gives up on us. Moral evil is thus our responsibility, but God is interested in our progress. He's interested in what is going on. And for Irenaeus, God is directly responsible for natural evil, for disease and for disasters. He has put it there as a kind of assault course to bring out the best in us, to call out from us great acts of heroism and charity. Now, when you join any of the services, well, certainly, if you join the Marines or I think the Army, you have to do these assault courses to get tougher and tougher. I mean, I don't know the guys who've been in the Navy and the Air Force, they probably let them have an easy time, but I think probably any military training is pretty hard. And so that natural evil is like that assault course. It's meant to challenge us, meant to, bring out the best in us. Now, there is a recognition here that in a totally protected and comfortable world, there would not be much human development. Many of you know that truth as parents. Sometimes you think you'd like to keep your children in cotton wool, never to let them out of the house. I can imagine it's like that if you're raising girls, isn't it? You know, you think, no, they're not going to have boyfriends. They're not going to be allowed out for the evening or whatever. You know, you just want to keep them safe, but you can't get away with that. It's you know, you just have to let them grow up. Deep down, you know that you have to expose them to physical, intellectual, and emotional challenges, because otherwise they'll never develop as adults. Now, there's a great writer, an American, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Her whole career was spent with the terminally ill. And she wrote a wonderful book on death and dying, and really, you know, educated people about the process of dying and also the need to care for the dying. She wrote, "The most beautiful people we have known are those who have known defeat, known suffering, known struggle, known loss, and have found their way out of the depths. These persons have an appreciation, a sensitivity, and an understanding of life that fills them with compassion, gentleness, and a deep loving concern. Beautiful people do not just happen." You know, that's a great phrase. Beautiful people do not just happen. You know, they grow out of challenges. "With the grace of God, the ugly things in life can bring forth beauty." So here is a totally different defense of God. He permits evil, even to a certain extent causes evil, so that we will grow up and become more complete human beings. Now, you may feel that even Irenaeus cannot get his client off scot-free. Most of us will recognize that challenge does lead to growth. But some people are crushed and diminished by those challenges, by those sufferings. Hasn't God made the assault course too tough for many people? Irenaeus insists that all is not lost. God can complete the work of maturing beyond this life, and all who turn to him for help will eventually be with him in heaven. You know, Irenaeus would see, you know, although the idea of purgatory is developed later after his time, he would understand that. He said, you know, that if we ask for God's help, there will be a time of purification beyond death, but beyond that, there is heaven. Now, these philosophical explanations of evil may be able to satisfy our reason, but they don't help very much in the moment of suffering, when we face illness or have lost a loved one. As a Catholic chaplain in local hospitals, called in day after day for emergencies, I would give last rites to people, often people at the end of long and fulfilling lives. And then, you know, it felt good to commend them to God. But I'd also have to give last rites to young people who had barely lived and whose deaths brought lasting sadness to their families. You know, not Thanksgiving like the after the life of somebody who's led a long and fulfilled life, but you know, those families would be left with great pain ever afterwards. Now, that was not a time to bring out the arguments I've talked about with you today. You know, can you imagine in a hospital room saying, "Oh yes, you know, your child has died, but St. Augustine, St. Irenaeus, there's very good theories about that. Let me explain it to you. You know, that's philosophy. Philosophy is from the head. And the philosopher cannot touch the suffering heart, because at that moment there still seems too great a distance between the omnipotent God and us who feel the pain here below. I'm reminded of Pope Francis's visit to the Philippines in 2015. You know, I have a great respect for Pope Francis because he was a highly intelligent man, trained as a Jesuit. You know, they have this long, long intellectual training in philosophy and in theology. But he wasn't just a man of the head. He was very much a man of the heart. So, on January the 18th, 2015, he was at an audience for university students in Manila. And he heard a short presentation from two street children. In the Philippines, there's this terrible problem of street children. They their parents have died, or their parents are in prison, or something like that, and that there is no mechanism to save them, to pick them up. You know, if there are any relatives, their relatives have no money to help them. There are some Catholic organizations which provide orphanages and homes to help them, but not nearly enough. And these street children talked about the poverty and the abuse and the crime that they'd seen in their short lives. And at the end of the talk, a 12-year-old girl asked the Pope, "Why does God allow this kind of suffering, even when kids are not to blame?" You know, it's so apparent. Those children with no parents, no one to care for them, they're not to blame, and yet they suffer terribly. Why does God allow that kind of suffering? And she simply broke down in tears as she asked that question. And the Pope embraced her, and he shared her suffering, shared her anguish, and he abandoned his official speech to try to respond to her question. You know, the Pope has like an official text of his speech there before him, you know, particularly if he's in a foreign country. And that text is published later on on the Vatican website. But Pope Francis wasn't always thinking, "Oh goodness, this has got to be published later on. I've got to say the right thing." He was prepared to just talk to people face to face. So he pointed, you know, in his reply, not an official reply, to the way that Jesus ministered to his people. Jesus did not meet people's needs in a worldly way. He didn't stop for a few moments to hand out money or material things. Rather, the Pope said, Christ took the time to listen and to sympathize with people. You know, he didn't solve the problem in a material way, but he took time with people. You know, we heard that last Sunday in the Gospel. You know, taking time with that Samaritan woman, having this long conversation, even when the disciples were scandalized by it. Rather, the Pope said, you know, Christ took time to listen, to sympathize, and he said this, Jesus in the gospel cried. He cried for his dead friend, Lazarus. He cried in his heart for the family that had lost its child. He was moved to tears, to compassion, when he saw the crowds without a shepherd. And he said, it's only when we learn to cry with the suffering that we begin to understand. He said at the end, let us learn how to weep as this little girl has shown us today how to weep. Let us not forget this lesson. And so, you know, that is not a philosophical response. It is a response of the heart. And it's something all of us can do. So in times of anguish, the only comfort is our faith that Jesus and his people, the church, suffer alongside us. We believe that in Jesus, God knew suffering, felt rejection, pain, and death. On the cross, he even knew that feeling which may come to some of us at some time, the feeling of being abandoned by God. My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? You know, that is the cry of the suffering. I was speaking recently to a man, you know, of my own age, in his 70s. Life was good. And then suddenly he discovered he'd got cancer. And he told me how angry he felt with God. You know, why has this come to me? And that is that, my God, why have you forsaken me? Even so, that cry from the cross is also the cry of faith. When we question God, when we accuse him, we are still acknowledging God. And if you read the Psalms, you get it all the time. The Psalms are a real human cry of the suffering. You know, the psalmist says at various times, you know, you have abandoned your people. God, why are you sleeping? Why do you not respond to us? It's the same cry, but it's still a conversation with God. It's still a statement of faith. And when we accuse God, we're still acknowledging him, and out of our despair and lack of understanding, trust can emerge. And that trust did emerge for Jesus. Father, into your hands I commend my spirit, he said at the very end. In times of trouble, maybe that's all that we can say. Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. But surely that is enough. So these talks, Scott is recording these, so you can actually listen to them if you want to listen to the audio again. But also there is also the text of the. So if you know you feel you've missed something, you can actually kind of look it up. But if there are any questions, but as I say, I can't always answer the questions, you know. Yes.
Is there such a thing as a just war if it's waged against pure evil, like the Nazis or the Muslims?
The Catholic Church does have a doctrine of just war. Yes, you know, when it's for example, for defense or for against extreme evil like the Nazis. But part of that doctrine of just war is what they call proportionality. And so there has to be some kind of balance between what goes on. And one of the things about the situation between Israel and Gaza. You know, Israel was attacked without any declaration of war. Many, many people were killed. Many, many innocent people were killed. You know, that's also part of the just war, that, you know, you can kill soldiers in a just war, but you should always protect the innocent and the civilian. So Israel had the right to respond, but the Pope Francis and then Pope Leo have been concerned about the proportionality, because so many people in Gaza were killed and still are being killed, and so many women and children have been killed. You know, totally sort of innocent people who are living in desperate poverty. But yes, there is the whole theory of just war. But nevertheless, obviously, we have to try and avoid war whenever possible. But yeah, that your example of the Nazis, something had to be done, absolutely. Yes. I think he would be more aligned with Irenaeus. You know, this sense that evil is in the world, but we have the possibility of creating good out of evil by our response to it. You know, since I retired, I watch much more TV than I'd ever watched before. Far too much TV. But I've been very impressed by those advertisements for St. Jude's Hospital, you know, which works with very, very sick children. They have the parents talking, and you know, you can see these are just kind of very ordinary people, you know, and maybe, you know, in their ordinary lives, not very impressive people, you know, just very, very ordinary American people. And yet, somehow, by, you know, having this desperately sick child and having the St. Jude's people working with them and caring for them, they have become very, very impressive people. They've become, you know, immensely deep people. They've become spiritual people. It can happen. But as I say, you know, sometimes those challenges are just too much for people. You know, people have the challenge and goodness knows they might kill their child or something like that. You know, such things happen. But good, you know, maturity, development can come out of those challenges. Yes, sorry. Well, that is St. Augustine's theory, yes. That evil is punishment. But he felt, this is Augustine, that kind of balanced up, you know. You had evil here, but God gave a good punishment here. And so, you know, like an accountant, in the end, it all balanced out. But as I said, we can't really accept that so much now.
So then wouldn't, even like for today, with God being omnipotent and all-powerful, or at least like omnipresent,
wouldn't that also, at least to some extent, him be responsible for, he has the ability to stop certain natural evils, and yet doesn't?
Well, that's because the world is as it is. And so, you know, there can be miracles, but miracles cannot be happening all the time. And actually, that's the fourth talk, is about miracles. But yeah, I mean, there is, we feel, some responsibility there. And that's why I say, you know, in the moment of suffering, you can't draw on those philosophical arguments to comfort people. They're not a comfort. Sorry, you had a question.
So we've talked several times about omnipotent, and omnipotent also means all-knowing, correct? So have any of the philosophers ever talked about, well, when God created man, he also gave man free will, knowing that free will may not be his choice, it's man's choice to make a decision. So when man is weak and makes a bad or evil decision, it's not God making the decision, it's man, as you talked about.
That's what we could, yeah, the free will defense, yeah, yeah.
I was just wondering if any philosophers specifically talked about free will, and it's not God's fault, it's man's free will of doing what they are doing with their free will. And maybe God felt it was a better benefit to give man free will, knowing that man will make mistakes along the way. The same way that you can tell a child 10 times, don't touch that hot stove, and you know the time you turn your back, they're going to touch the hot stove.
Yeah.
It's not that God's not loving. He's loving to the point of giving this gift of free will, and whether you choose to use the gift correctly or not.
It is. I mean, you know, that as I say, you know, free will is a wonderful gift to human beings, you know, that we have this capacity to choose between good and evil. And most of the time we feel it's kind of worth the price, you know. But as I said, in the kind of rebuttal, why did some of the angels, you know, in a perfect world, suddenly choose to do evil? Yes, they, yeah, but why would they choose to go the wrong way? And then, you know, involve, and, you know, Augustine was taking that story, as it were, at face value.
But it's the same way the smartest child in the room might cheat on a test. Why did he do that?
Yeah.
He knew the answer. You know, it's so complex.
Yeah, and also, you know, that, as I said, with the example of the Holocaust, that was free will. You know, the free will of Hitler, but also all the people with him, and many of the German people, they kind of refused to even see what was going on. And so, you know, some people will say, when the free will is of that scale, is so terrible, you know, surely God should intervene. Yeah.
But then he'd take away free will.
But would take away free will, yeah.
Father, just in response to this gentleman's question, just on the natural side, good does come from natural disasters. Just as an example, my grandparents, they were flooded out of their home and business and had to move to another state. I wouldn't be here today if they hadn't moved to this other state and my father met my mother. You know, if there hadn't been this flood, I wouldn't be here.
Right, yes.
Yeah,
are we saying good came out of evil?
so much of this depends, to begin with, is your faith. And it's about the only way you can accept the tragedies and things that happen around you. And sometimes those, you can be in the midst of a lot of tragedy and in the hospitals with the children. But in that, there's gonna be one of those that's going to be the miracle child that stays.
Yeah.
And it's a faith in a person. If you don't start with some kind of belief, you're not going to be able to accept some of these things.
Right. I mean, I was felt that I could not be Jewish because the Jews have the sense of God the Father and only God the Father, and God the Father is up there in heaven. But our belief is that God has come to earth and been mixed up with our humanity and lived our humanity and, you know, even to the point of being rejected, suffering, dying, suffering in every way. And, you know, that makes to me a huge difference, the incarnation and all that follows from the incarnation. Well, we better get ready for Mass. All right.
Get ready for some
all right, God bless you.